This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified 96 years ago this month. It gave women the right to vote throughout the nation. How women voted in the 1920s and 30s, the early elections after getting the right to vote, is the focus of a new book. Counting Women's Ballots, Female Voters from Suffrage Through the New Deal, is co-authored by Western Michigan University political science professor Kevin Corder, who joins us in studio. Thanks for being here.
Morning.
And Christina Wolbrecht, political science professor and director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy at the University of Notre Dame, and she joins the conversation via Skype. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
What made you want to write a book about women's suffrage, particularly those early elections? Christina.
So women in politics in general is a long interest of mine. And of course, for most Americans, voting is the primary way in which they engage in politics. And so for women to be denied that opportunity to basically participate in self-government, to decide who is going to be the people who represent us, make laws, govern us, is a really major part of how women engage in the political world. And the achievement of the 19th Amendment is a major transformation of really women's citizenship and their place in American politics. But knowing all that, I also knew that we know a lot about the suffrage movement. We know a lot about the process that got us the 19th Amendment. And then our history books and our textbooks and our political science sort of goes away. There really was not a lot of information out there about how women actually used the vote. If you read a lot of standard textbooks, you see almost nothing about it until sort of the second wave of the women's movement emerges in the late 60s, early 70s, and then we discover the gender gap in the 1980 election. But it was as if women won the right to vote, but our knowledge of what they actually did with that was almost non-existent. And so I was really curious about that and was lucky to have the opportunity to work with Kevin to try to help us learn something all these years later, almost 100 years later, about how women actually use those ballots that they fought so very hard to secure.
But you tell us early on that this is not an easy question to answer because we really don't know how individual voters cast their ballots based on the official records that we have. And of course, back in the 1920, 24, 28, 32 elections, you did not have the rather sophisticated exit polling that we have today. So give us kind of a brief description of how you went about trying to figure out how women were actually voting in these early elections.
We collected a huge amount of data on from the U.S. Census about the proportion of women in various counties and wards and townships, and another set of data with the election returns, and merged those together and used a relatively new or novel statistical technique to recover the individual level behavior. We did have one state, Illinois, where they counted women and men's ballots separately. They had red and blue ballots. Because we were able to see in a couple of places or a couple of states in Illinois, in a couple of elections in Illinois, the way women voted, we could verify or validate that the approach that we used using aggregate data actually worked.
Now, of course, these elections that we're talking about had some kind of big events surrounding them. There was the debate over prohibition. Of course, the Great Depression comes along in the late 1920s. So there's a lot of, as we call them, extraneous variables in there. How do you kind of tease out what might have affected swings in the electorate in terms of those factors, kind of traditional political factors, from having women vote for the first time?
I think it's fair to say that we saw a number of the things that you've described as really opportunities. So while there isn't a lot of good or wasn't a lot of good hard data about how women actually voted during this period, if you looked really closely, there were certainly some ideas. So you mentioned progressives. Women had been leaders of the progressive movement. The temperance movement had been a big part of progressivism. Women had been leaders of that. And so you might expect then that, boy, if women were given the opportunity to support progressive candidates, we'd expect them to do so. Well, in 1924, just the second presidential election after the 19th Amendment, there was a major progressive candidate for president, Robert M. La Follette. And so that election lets us look really directly at that sort of question. Did women actually, in general, we see them as leaders in this movement, but when it came to voting, did they actually show up for the progressives? Or you mentioned the New Deal, when we have this huge change in American politics. The Republicans have been the absolute dominant party from the end of the Civil War war. Well, the New Deal, the Great Depression changes all that, and Franklin Roosevelt puts together this huge coalition of Democrats. That's a really big change. And we might think that new voters, like women, might have contributed to that in unique or different ways. And so being able to look at those elections, which are, again, just the fourth and fifth presidential elections after the 19th Amendment, are really great opportunities to get a different sense of how women voted under different conditions.
There's a quote at the end of chapter two from feminist Suzanne La Follette. It is a misfortune for the women's movement that it has succeeded in securing political rights for women at the very time that they are worth less than they have been at any time since the 18th century. Now, what was she talking about there? Why did she say that? And did that turn out to be true?
There's a little irony there. In the 19th century, politics was really dominated by political parties and their ability to mobilize and organize voters. We had incredibly strong political parties and in many places, party machines. But at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, we see more and more groups, rather than organizing through parties, organizing as interests, what we would today think of as sort of mass interest groups. And the irony is that women were really at the forefront of doing that because they lacked the opportunity to organize through parties because they couldn't vote. That's what parties did. They organized voters. Women really pioneered forms of what today we would call lobbying, trying to affect public opinion, meeting with members of legislatures, et cetera. And pretty quickly, other interests sort of caught on to the fact that, boy, organizing all these voters to try to elect people, that's actually a lot of work. In some ways, sort of direct lobbying is a lot easier and a lot more useful. And so we see sort of a shift to more of that interest organized or interest-oriented politics around the turn of the 20th century. So there is this sort of irony that author is noting, that women get the vote when really that's becoming less the way in which political power is used, and rather we're seeing sort of the organization and of interests and lobbying and sort of going in a different direction in terms of political power.
The 19th Amendment was enacted on August 26, 1920, and as you note in the book, that is not very long before Election Day. Did that blunt maybe the impact that the women's vote could have had on the 1920 election?
It's certainly true that there was only a short number of weeks, I'll get it wrong if I try to say exactly how many, between the actual ratification. That anniversary is actually this Friday, which is now recognized as Women's Equality Day, when the 19th Amendment was ratified, and that November election in 1920. That being said, it was pretty clear that summer that it was fairly inevitable that the amendment was going to be ratified. Which state would put it over, it ended up being Tennessee, was unclear, but there was a pretty good sense that the amendment would in fact be ratified. So some states actually took steps beforehand to help women become voters, basically. And so in some states where, for example, women were allowed to vote on school boards already, there were some states that gave women limited suffrage like that. Those states already sort of rolled women over from the school board registration list to the regular voting lists. So we saw that in some places. In many other states, in that period from the ratification of the 19th Amendment before the election, they held special registration days just for women. They had extended hours where they'd be open at nights and weekends. Boston's a great example of this. The Boston Registrar, almost in a complaining sense, in their official documents in 1920, talks about what an expense it was to have extra registrars and extra time to ensure that women who wanted to register to vote in advance of 1920 could. That being said, the fact is that in four southern states in 1920, women still were not able to vote. Those states had very long registration periods. You had to register at least 6 months in advance of the election. Those state legislatures could have chosen to waive that requirement for women. They chose not to. And so they basically said, oh, sorry, women, you missed your chance to register to vote, and you will have to sit out the 1920 election, despite the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and we'll see you in 1924.
Were there efforts ongoing beyond 1920 to make it more difficult for women to vote in any way?
Well, it's worth saying a couple of things. First of all, the ratification of the 19th Amendment theoretically enfranchises all women. Of course, for women of color, particularly in the South, where most people of color lived during this period, those women faced the same barriers to voting that African-American men did. And so for them, true enfranchisement would not be realized until the 1960s, and particularly the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Beyond that, certainly different states had different regulations about voting, as we've already suggested. And one of the findings that comes out of the book is that things like literacy tests, poll taxes, other sorts of barriers to voting seem to impact women to a greater extent than they did men. Women became even more reluctant to vote when they were faced with sort of that extra hurdle for getting to the ballot box.
Gordon had asked about how did we control for other factors when we tried to look at men and women. So the sample of states that we used had a variety of conditions. Some were highly competitive. Some were one-party dominant. Some were very relaxed restrictions about voting. Some were very strict requirements for early registration. So we're able to see how women behaved across these contexts. And as Christina said, we found that the weight of electoral laws was much stronger or bigger for women. We also found that competition mattered in places where elections were competitive, even in the presence of restrictive laws, women turned out to vote pretty impressive rates.
So if we look at the 1920 election, it was a good year for the Republicans. Did women contribute to that significantly?
Sure. To say it's a good year for the Republicans would be an understatement. We're talking over 60% of the vote for Warren Harding. And so it was over 60% of the vote for both men and for what the newer women voters. And women were just a little bit more supportive of Harding, especially in the states where the Republican Party had been traditionally strong.
And then 1924, Harding had passed away. So Calvin Coolidge was running for president at that point. And again, the Republicans did pretty well.
Yeah. And again, it was women who were more likely to support the Republican candidate than men, which meant that La Follette, the progressive challenger, didn't do as well as he did among women. He did better among men. So women kind of stabilized the electorate in that sense that maintained that Republican dominance in 24.
Now, what we see in these first few elections is also a drop overall in voter turnout. Can that be attributed to women becoming first-time voters, perhaps not knowing all the mechanisms that you have to go through, Christina, to know what they have to do to legally cast their ballot?
Sure. So there were a lot of things that contributed to unquestionably lower turnout among women. So on average, across the states that we looked at, over 60% of men are turning out to vote, nearly 70% actually, in, say, 1920, compared to about 36% of women. One of the things we emphasize in the book, however, is that varies dramatically across the states. So places like Virginia, that's very uncompetitive and has a lot of barriers to voting, women's turnout was extremely low. Around 10%, as opposed to in more competitive places. Actually, as Kevin already suggested, it was pretty impressive, the percentage of women who turned out to vote. Not as high as men, but more than 50%, more than half of women turning out to vote in the first election in which they're eligible.
In Kentucky, yeah, in Kentucky and in Missouri.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kevin. Now, there were, of course, barriers. The idea that politics was an inappropriate activity for women didn't just disappear with the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And we actually have a few surveys, particularly a famous one of Chicago from the early 1920s, that shows that there was still a non-negligible percentage of women who said, no, I don't believe in women voting, or my family doesn't believe in women voting, as their reason for why they didn't participate. For some, as you suggested, it would be lack of experience. And so we know that voting is a habit, and if people haven't done it before, it's less likely that they'll do it in the future. And so since women have been denied that opportunity, that certainly we can expect contributed to their lower turnout. It is interesting to note, though, in many places, the League of Women Voters, what had been the National American Women's Suffrage Association, turned itself into League of Women Voters, and other organizations, in particular political parties, put up booths and things at places like state fairs where they basically wanted to teach women how to vote. They would have ballot boxes and polling places and curtains that you could put across your little cubicle there, so you could practice voting. Newspapers would run stories, basically trying to explain to women, sometimes in very patronizing tones, like you can't take your husband with you into the polling place, but trying to basically help women learn, as you suggest, the very basic mechanics of how to vote, to hopefully encourage them to do so.
So the 1928 election saw the Democrats nominate Al Smith. He campaigned in part on a promise that he would work to repeal prohibition. And of course, the women's movement had been big in trying to get prohibition enacted. So did Al Smith out of the gate hurt himself with women voters by pledging to try and repeal the 18th Amendment?
Well, there was this sense that at the time that the Smith candidacy and the issue of prohibition would really stimulate huge turnout among women. And even retrospectively, when people looked at it, they kind of bought into that assumption and said that this election was one where women really entered in large numbers. But what we found was the Smith candidacy didn't just mobilize women, it mobilized men as well. So there were huge numbers of men who entered the electorate at the same time as there were huge numbers of women entering the electorate. So it wasn't just about women being motivated by these issues that people were passionate about. It was men and women. So that election, the kind of expectation that women were going to come in and just support him because of or oppose him because of prohibition, we didn't find that. In fact, we found that in states that were highly Democratic, the women remained supporters of the Democratic Party. In states that were Republican, they remain supporters of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that 1928 really highlights is, you know, we talk about women voters as if there's some undifferentiated mass. And so that election was highly mobilizing, as Kevin said, of both men and women. But for women and men as well, on both sides of the issue. So for many immigrants and immigrant women who had not previously either been able to vote, the naturalization process takes a while. There have been huge numbers of immigrants coming to the United States in those the decades preceding 1928. They were excited to vote for Al Smith, for their, another immigrant ethnic from New York, really sort of seemed to represent. He's, of course, the first Catholic nominee. And so in Northeastern states, where huge percentages of the population were first and second generation immigrants in the 1920s, a lot of that mobilization is for Smith. In other parts of the country where the population looks different, where you have more native-born whites who tend to be Protestant, there they were sort of aghast at the possibility of a Al Smith presidency because of prohibition, because of anti-Catholic sentiment, for lots of reasons. And there, again, for both women and men, the mobilization was against Smith. So it's really important to remember that just like men, women are affected by all sorts of different interests, concerns, and characteristics.
So then we move to 1932. Of course, in the intervening years, there's the Great Depression. The Democrats nominate Franklin Roosevelt. But as you note in this book, the way that there's a shift from one party to another is that there are some voters who have voted Republican in this case who decide, well, I'm going to vote Democratic because of what has happened. And then there's also bringing in new voters. And you raise an interesting point here about perhaps women had not fully formed their partisan identity, even if they'd been voting Republican and it had only been for a few elections. So does it seem to be that women were more likely, if they had voted Republican in the past, to vote for the Democratic candidate for president and maybe other offices in 1932?
Well, I think, as you mentioned before, we found that women entered the electorate as supporters of the major party in the region where they were entering the polls. And so they were a little bit more supportive of Republicans in those early elections. And then we find that they're a little bit more supportive of the Democrats in the later elections. So that would suggest that women were brought in to the electorate in more Democratic than men, and women who were currently Republican defected at a little bit higher rate. But the differences are fairly modest in terms of the defection rates. So women came in a little bit more loyal to Republicans, and then they moved a little bit more in favor of the Democrats. So higher defection rates, but not by a large number.
You also tell us in this book that political reporters in this day kept writing that the next election was going to be the one where the women's vote would determine the winner. Now, we do know that that has happened. It certainly happened probably in 2012. As you say in this book, if the 19th Amendment had never been passed, Mitt Romney would probably be president right now. He won the men's vote, but President Obama won enough of the women's vote to be reelected. But is there a point before that we can find an election where we could say, the women's vote determined the winner of an election to high office?
Well, I was going to say that language, this is going to be the year that women make the difference, probably sounds familiar to you and to many of your listeners, since it is certainly something that we hear all the time now. And your description of the outcome of 2012 is exactly right. Women have been, overall, in general, more likely to identify with and vote for Democratic candidates than Republican candidates since at least 1980. And there's some evidence that that development begins earlier than that, beginning in the late 1960s. It's worth saying that has as much to do with men being more likely to favor Republicans than women favoring Democrats. Those trends sort of move both ways. If there's a difference, it doesn't mean it's all women's fault. It's the behavior of men as well. You can certainly find individual Senate or House races where you might be able to find that they're that close, that it makes a difference. In most cases, the percentage of women voting different than the percentage of men is not enough to sort of change the outcome of elections, in part because below the level of the president, many elections are not actually particularly close. It is worth saying that there have been more women in the presidential electorate, and women have been more likely to vote since 1980. So that combination of the fact that, basically more women are voting, again, but not by huge numbers, but there are more women, with a slight preference in most cases for Democratic candidates, does make it possible that in a close election, women could make the difference. One of the things we try to do in this book, however, is to emphasize that even if women aren't the deciding factor, and, we can always slice up the electorate in lots of ways and say, this all came down to married people, or this all came down to Hispanic voters, or whatever it was. What we're really interested in is what contribution did women make? How were elections different because women participated in them? And I think that remains an important question to ask about elections. It was an important question 100 years ago, and it's an important question today.
So we're talking, of course, in 2016, which is the year that we have the first woman nominee for president of a major political party. Can we go back and maybe draw a line and say that there was some encouragement for women to get into politics in different ways once women's suffrage became the law of the land?
So these things are certainly related. The first thing I'll say is there was actually a surprisingly large number of women who ran for political office prior to the ratification of the 19th Amendment. The Constitution certainly doesn't forbid women from running from any office. And as is the case for most aspects of elections, those things are decided at the state level. There's a great website called Her Hat Was in the Ring, I believe, .org, that is sort of going through the historical record and has found more than 3,000 women, they may be up to 4,000 now, who have run for various offices from, county clerks up to members of Congress prior to the 19th Amendment. That being said, with the ratification of the 19th Amendment and nationwide, the idea that women would be permitted to cast ballots, that wasn't just about that one political act. I think it's fair to say that it was a recognition that women are contributors to our political world and to our polity more generally, and certainly opened up the possibility and was seen as a transformation of the relationship between women and the political arena, a sort of chipping away of that idea that women belong in the private sphere and men belong in the public sphere, which is where politics is, but only a chipping away. So it's going to take some time. And the sort of growth in the representation of women in political offices was very slow from the 20s through until about the 70s, because it turns out you need resources to run for office. And those resources are controlled by people, mostly in the mid-20th century men. You need ambition for political office to put yourself forward. And if you don't see any other women in office, it's hard to imagine yourself as a political candidate. You need characteristics. So women needed to, you know, make gains in terms of education and income and those sorts of things. And so while certainly I think that chipping away of the barrier for women involvement in the political in the public sphere that happened with the granting of suffrage was huge, it was really just one step. And frankly, we've even with a woman at the top of the of a major party ticket this year, we still have barriers and that we're chipping away at to make it possible for more women to be elected to political office.
So when we look back at these first four presidential elections after women had been granted the right to vote through the 19th Amendment, can we say that there was some sort of pattern set there that has some relevance today?
Well, one of the things we noticed that frankly came as a surprise, I think, to both of us was that women were less likely to support the third party candidates at the level of the president. There had been some earlier work on trustee elections in Illinois that showed that women were more likely to support a third party candidate. There were some expectations related to women's support for prohibition that they'd support candidates maybe on the prohibition ticket. But we found that they didn't. And when we went back and looked at contemporary American national election studies, you see the same thing. Whether it's Ralph Nader in 2000 or it's Wallace in 1968, women are half as likely as men to support third-party candidates. So that loyalty to the major parties has persisted. And I think that's something, I don't know if it's something that was set in stone, but it's something that we found then that you still see now that could be important today. Which is just simply that the third-party candidates are less likely to get traction among women than they are among men.
I think that's absolutely right. And the other thing I would add is what's fascinating to me is that over 100 years, our narrative, the way that we discuss women voters, has also, regardless of what they've actually done, regardless of their actual turnout, their actual vote choice, whether they're voting for Republicans or Democrats, the assumptions we make about what motivates women voters, the idea that they're more caring, that they worry about, that they're motivated by sympathy for the plight of the poor, for example, that they're more compassionate, that religion motivates their vote choice more than it does men's, that they're particularly driven by women's specific issues as opposed to caring about the economy or foreign policy like we assume that men do. The tone of it, the actual the content shifts, but those themes seem to come up again and again and again as we talk about women voters. Again, even as their actual presence and behavior in the electorate shifts.
So do one of you, or maybe both of you, want to explore this topic more? Is this something that we could see another book about, or at least maybe some more research on women's voting behavior in the near future?
Yes. So actually, we are. So we're working on a book that combines our research on the early voting behavior with some recently reclaimed polling data from the Gallup organization that has data about women's vote choice through surveys from 1936 to 1945, and then we'll tap contemporary data to come up with the kind of entire record from 1920 until through 2016 for a century of votes for women. And so the plan is to see how our findings from the 20s and 30s lined up with the polling data and the more recent and contemporary to really see how women's voting both evolved since we looked at it in the 1920s and 30s.
Well, I guess we'll have to do this again somewhere down the road.
Absolutely.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gordon.
Kevin Corder is a political science professor at Western Michigan University. He joined us in studio. Christina Wolbrecht is a professor of political science and director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy at the University of Notre Dame. She joined us via Skype. They are co-authors of the book Counting Women's Ballots, Female Voters from Suffrage Through the New Deal. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.